Louisa hesitated. She wanted to approach Leo too, but thought they shouldn't.
"He'll tell Mom," she said.
Nora nodded, mouth drawn tight, disappointed. They both held still, barely breathing, and watched Leo for a few minutes. He stood and brushed off his pants. He sat on a large boulder.
"What is he doing?"
Nora whispered as Leo stared up at the sky. She wished they were a normal family. She wished she could run down the path waving and he'd smile and laugh and they could spend the day together. Instead, here they were, cowering behind a tree. They didn't have all the details of his trip to rehab, but they knew there was some kind of accident and that it was bad and involved drugs.
"Who does blow anymore?"
Louisa had heard her mother say to their father one night last summer.
"He might be buying drugs," Louisa said, looking at Nora, worried. "Why else would he be all the way up here right before lunch?"
Leo sighed and hoisted himself up, brushing twigs and dirt off his pants. He sat on a nearby rock, assessing the damage to his scraped palms. Something nagged at him. Something about the girls. He'd really spooked them. He assumed his fall was inelegant, but couldn't imagine that he looked dangerous. Why had they been so spooked? Kids probably weren't allowed anywhere in the park without a parent these days. Not even teens. Not even boys. Those girls were probably already looking for a cop.
"Damn it," Leo thought. "What if they were looking for a cop? What if they thought he was drunk or worse and gave his description to the police who were patrolling for him right now?"
He couldn't be caught with drugs. His lawyer had been crystal clear. "Keep your nose clean until the divorce decree comes down. No travel, no suspicious spending, no trouble." Leo stood and headed toward the sound of traffic. At the top of the path, he turned a corner and finally knew exactly where he was. Central Park West was straight ahead. He could hail a taxi and go directly to Grand Central and not be late for lunch. If he made a right, he'd be at Strawberry Fields within 2 or 3 minutes. He hesitated. Above him, an ear-splitting screech. He looked up to see 3 enormous crows, perched on one of the few trees that had already dropped its leaves. They were all squawking at once as if they were arguing about his next move. Directly beneath, in the midst of the stark and barren branches, and at the base of a forked limb, a mud-brown, leafy mass. A nest. Jesus. Leo checked the time and started walking. Chapter 2. Nobody remembered who started calling their eventual inheritance the nest, but the name stuck. Melody was just 16 when Leonard Plum Sr. decided to establish a trust for his children. "Nothing significant," he would tell them repeatedly. "A modest nest egg, conservatively invested, dispersed in time for you to enjoy but not exploit." The funds, Leonard Sr. explained, would not be available until Melody, the youngest, turned 40. Jack was the first to argue vociferously against this distribution, wanting to know why they all couldn't have their share sooner and pointing out that Melody would get the money earlier in her life than everyone else, and what was fair about that. But Leonard had given the distribution of funds, how much and when, a great deal of thought. Leonard was, and this was quite literally how he thought of himself several times a day, a self-made man. It was the organizing principle of his life— that money and its concurrent rewards should flow from work, effort, commitment, and routine. At one time, the Plums of Eastern Long Island had family money and a decent amount of real estate. Decades of behavioral blunders and ill-conceived marriages and businesses run amok had left next to nothing by the time Leonard was in high school. He'd wangled himself an engineering scholarship to Cornell and then a job with Dow Chemical during a time he referred to, reverently, as the dawn of the absorbency revolution. Leonard had lucked onto a team working with a new substance, synthetic polymers that could absorb 300 times more liquid than conventional organic absorbents like paper and cotton.
As his colleagues set to work identifying potential uses for the new superabsorbers, agriculture, industrial processing, architecture, military applications, Leonard seized on something else. Consumer products. According to Leonard's oft-repeated legend, the business he and his two partners started, advising larger corporations on how to use the new absorbers, was nearly solely responsible for daintier feminine hygiene products, which he never failed to mention in mixed company, mortifying his children, better disposable diapers, his proudest accomplishment, he'd spent a small fortune on a diaper service when the first three were babies, and the quilted square of revolting plastic that still sits beneath every piece of slaughtered meat or poultry in the supermarket. He was not above rooting through the garbage at a dinner party and hoisting the discarded square triumphantly, saying, "Mine!" Leonard built a thriving business based on absorbency, and it was the thing he was proudest of, the fact of his life that lent a sweet gleam to all his accomplishments. He was not a materialistic man. The exterior of his roomy Tudor house was scrupulously maintained, the interior one tick short of slovenly. He was loath to spend money on anything he thought he could fix himself, and he believed he could fix everything. The contents of the Plum House existed in varying states of disrepair, waiting for Leonard's attention and marked with his handwritten notes. A hairdryer that could only be held with a mittened potholder because the cracked handle overheated so quickly. Use with care. Outlets that delivered tiny electric shocks. Use upper, not lower. Leaky coffee makers. Use sparingly. Bikes with no brakes. Use with caution. And countless defunct blenders, tape recorders, televisions, stereo components. Do not use. Years later, unconsciously at first, and then deliberately because it made them laugh and was a neat private shorthand, B and Leo would borrow Leonard's note vernacular for editing manuscripts. Use more. Use sparingly. Do not use. Leonard was a careful, conservative investor in blue-chip stocks. He was happy to set aside some funds to provide a modest safety net for his children's future. But he also wanted them to be financially independent and to value hard work. He'd grown up around trust fund kids, knew many of them still, and he'd seen the damage an influx of early money caused. Abundance proffered too soon led to lassitude and indolence, a wandering dissatisfaction. The trust he established was meant to be a soupçon, a little something to sit atop their own, inevitable financial achievements. They were his children, after all, and pad their retirement a bit, maybe help fund a college tuition or two. Nothing so vast as to be truly significant. Keeping the money tied up until Melody was 40 appealed to Leonard for many reasons. He was realistic about the maturity, emotional and otherwise, of his four children. Not commendable. He suspected if they didn't get the money all at once, it would become a source of conflict between those who had it and those who didn't. They wouldn't be kind to one another. And if anyone was going to need the money earlier in life, Leonard imagined it would be Melody. She wasn't the brightest of the four, that would be Bee, or the most charming, Leo, or the most resourceful, Jack. On the long list of things Leonard didn't believe in, near the top was paying strangers to manage his money. So one summer evening he enlisted his second cousin, George Plum, who was an attorney, to meet for dinner and hammer out the details of his estate. It never occurred to Leonard that evening, as he and George leisurely made their way through two Gibson martinis, a superior Parmard, 28 ounces of ribeye with cream spinach, cigars, and brandy, that in less than 2 years he would be felled by a massive coronary behind the wheel of his scrupulously maintained 15-year-old BMW sedan while driving home from work one late night. He never imagined that the bull market of the aughts, riding on mortgage-backed securities, would balloon the trust far beyond his intention. Nor could he have foreseen how the staid but eerily prescient George would providentially transfer the nest to the safer havens of bonds right before the market's decline in 2008, protecting the capital that the Plum siblings had watched during the decade before Melody's 40th birthday inflate to numbers beyond their wildest dreams. He never imagined that as the fund grew, so too would his children's tolerance for risk, for doing the one thing Leonard had repeatedly warned them not to do, ever, in any avenue of life, from the time they were old enough to understand. Count the chickens before they hatched. The only person who could access the funds early was Francie, and in spite of her casual allegiance to Leonard while he was alive, or maybe because of it, she married her second husband practically within minutes of shedding her widow's weeds, she abided by Leonard's wishes to the letter. Her interest in her children, anemic when she was actually responsible for them, dwindled to the occasional holiday brunch or birthday phone call. Leo was the only one who had never petitioned Francie for a loan using the nest as collateral. Jack and Melody and Bee had all asked at one time that she consider an earlier dispersal. But she stubbornly refused. Until Leo's accident. Chapter 3. The day Leo was released from rehab, a few days before the family lunch at the Oyster Bar, he went straight to his Tribeca apartment hoping to broker some civil temporary living arrangement with his about-to-be ex-wife, Victoria. That she had other plans became clear when his key no longer fit in the lock of the front door. "Don't bother fighting this one," George told him over the phone. "Just find a hotel. Remember my advice. Lie low." Leo didn't want to confess to George that Bee had taken his wallet the night of the accident. He'd arrived at rehab with nothing more than his house keys, his iPhone, which was immediately confiscated and returned to him the day he was released, and $60 in his pocket. Ditto. Standing at the Franklin Street subway station, paging through the contacts on his phone, he realized with deflating clarity how few people in Manhattan would be happy to lend him their sofa, how many friendships he'd let wane and diminish over the past few years while he and Victoria indulged each other's miseries and spent money as if it were somehow magically regenerating, how few people would be sorry to hear he'd had some trouble and would hope for his recovery or return. He'd lived in New York for more than 20 years and had never not had a place to go home to. The small piece of paper with a cell phone number on it, pressed on him by his rehab roommate, just in case, felt like a squirming minnow in his back pocket. He took the paper out, punched the numbers into his phone, and left a message before he had time to think about it, which was exactly the opposite of what he'd been incessantly lectured to do during his stay in Bridges, the recovery center where his family had dumped him for 12 endless weeks. He'd hated every minute of it. Individual therapy hadn't been half bad. He'd vented practically non-stop about Victoria and had almost exhausted his bitterness over her avarice. He almost felt like getting rid of her was worth the enormous price tag. Almost. But he should have negotiated something about the apartment for the next week or two. The wool jacket he was wearing was not nearly warm enough. The day was unusually cold for October. He was vaguely aware of an ominous weather report. The New York Post headline at the subway newsstand screamed, "Snowtober." As Leo stood waiting for a return call on his phone, he watched two panhandlers at the subway entrance compete for change. On one side, an elderly homeless guy was holding a knit cap in his hand and exuberantly addressing passers-by with a hearty, "Hello, stay dry, cold one today." And in what Leo thought was a particularly brilliant marketing move, exhorting all the small children to read a book. "Did you read a book today, young man?" he'd say. "Don't forget to read a book." The kids would smile shyly and nod, chew on a finger while dropping a parent-supplied dollar bill into the paper bag at the guy's feet. On the opposite side, a young, bare-headed musical student, smart, Leo thought, his head of streaked blonde curls was impressive, had a violin tucked under his elongated chin. He was playing popular classical riffs, lots of Vivaldi, a little Bach, and was very popular with the ladies not pushing strollers, the older ones in their fur coats, the younger ones wearing headphones or carrying reusable shopping bags. The pelting rain that had been falling all morning was changing over to sleet. Whoever was on the other end of the phone number hadn't called him back yet. He didn't have an umbrella, didn't even have a hat, and the shoulders of his expensive jacket were soaking wet. He paged through the contacts on his phone again, looked at Stephanie's name for a few seconds, and hit call. "Things must be worse than I've heard if you're begging to cross the bridge to Brooklyn," Stephanie said to Leo. She picked up after only the third ring. "I'm not begging. I need to spend some time with somebody normal, somebody I actually like." Stephanie didn't respond. She wasn't going to make this easy. "What have you heard, anyway?" Leo asked, "about my situation." He braced himself. This was another reason he needed to see Stephanie, to figure out how much of the story was out there, see if George had done what he promised. "Hardly anything," Stephanie said. "I heard you checked into Bridges, that's it. Your consigliere is doing a good job." "So, how was it?"
"How was what?"
"The carnival cruise," Stephanie said, trying to decide how far she could push on the phone. "Probably not very far."
"You are still not quite as funny as you think," Leo said, trying to decide how much he'd have to cede before she invited him out. "Probably not much."
"How was rehab, Leo? What else would I be asking about?"
"It was fine." Leo's fingers were starting to go numb in the cold.
"Are you all beholden to your higher power, working through the steps?"
"It wasn't really that kind of place," Leo said.
"What kind of place was it?"
"Steph, I don't know if you've looked out the window recently, but I'm standing outside in a monsoon of freezing sleet. I'm soaking wet. It's really cold."
He stomped his feet a little to try to warm his toes. He wasn't used to being in this situation, waiting on a request.
"Come out. You know where I live."
"What subway do I take?"
He cringed, hearing himself sound so eager and grateful.
"My lord," Stephanie said, laughing. "Brooklyn and not via town car? I guess the mighty really have fallen. You know there aren't tokens anymore, right? You have to buy something called a Metro card."
Leo didn't say anything. Of course he knew about the Metro card. But he realized he'd probably never bought one.
"Leo," Stephanie asked, "do you have enough money for a Metro card?"
"Yes."
"Come then." Her voice softened a bit at the edges. "Take the 2 or 3 to Bergen Street. I'm roasting lamb."
When Stephanie's phone rang that afternoon, she'd been throwing fistfuls of rock salt down her front stoop ahead of the purported storm. She knew before she answered that it was Leo. She was not a superstitious person, did not believe in second sight or premonitions or ghosts. But she'd always had an intuition around all things Leo. So she wasn't surprised when she heard his voice, realized that some part of her was waiting for him to call. She'd run into his wife some weeks prior at a bistro in Soho and found herself on the receiving end of Victoria's vituperative torrent, light on details, hard on recriminations.
"Good riddance to that narcissistic sociopath," Victoria had said, sliding her arm through her apparent date's, a television actor Stephanie recognized from one of those police procedurals. Victoria was vague when Stephanie asked why Leo was in rehab.
"Because he's a coward," she said. "Because he'd rather sleep it off in Connecticut and hope everyone forgives and forgets, as usual."
"Forgives and forgets what?" Stephanie persisted.
The bar was overflowing, and the three of them, gently jostled by the crowd, were swaying as if standing on the deck of a boat. Victoria stared hard at Stephanie.
"You never liked me," she said, crossing her skeletal arms and giving Stephanie the self-satisfied smile of someone who just realized the answer to a riddle.
"I don't dislike you," Stephanie said, which was untrue. She very much disliked Victoria. Or, rather, all Victoria represented. Everything about Leo that was superficial, glib, careless.
Everything about him that had gone so wrong once he sold Speakeasy Media and left everyone behind, including her.
I don't even know you.
Well, know this for when Leo inevitably reappears, Victoria had said, leaning so close that Stephanie could smell garlic and shellfish and cigarettes on her breath, could see a tiny smear of dragon red lipstick on one of her preternaturally bleached front teeth.
I'm getting everything. Every last cent. Leo can rot in rehab or in hell for all I care. Pass it on.
So when Leo called from the subway sounding sheepish, by Leo standards, and needing shelter, she was curious. Curious to see if rehab had rendered him even the tiniest bit transformed, sober or renewed or regretful. She knew he was probably just the same old Leo working an angle. Still, she wanted to see for herself. And if she was being perfectly honest, and she was because she'd fought hard to value honesty above nearly everything else, she was flattered Leo had turned to her when he needed help. Grateful she was still on his list. And because of that, she'd have to be very careful. Leo didn't have anything against Brooklyn. He just preferred Manhattan, and he believed anyone who said they didn't was lying. Still, as he walked from the Bergen Street stop into Prospect Heights and down Stephanie's block, he had to admit that the rapidly falling snow did something decidedly romantic to the streets lined with 19th-century brownstones. The cars on the block were already hidden under a sodden layer of white. People were shoveling their walks and front stoops. The scattered rock salt looked like white confetti against the bluestone slate sidewalks. Hands shoved in his pockets against the cold. Leo felt like a character from an Edith Wharton novel as he lifted the latch of the black iron front gate and walked past the gas lamplight in front of Stephanie's house. The wooden shutters lining the curved bay window were open, and as he climbed the stoop, he could see into the living room where she had a fire going. He should have stopped to buy flowers or wine or something. He stood before the massive mahogany and glass front doors. Stephanie had hung life-size plastic glow-in-the-dark skeletons in the two center panes. He hesitated a minute and then rang the bell. Three short ones, two long. The buzzer code they used for each other back in the day. One of the doors swung open. The skeletons clicked and swayed in the stormy breeze, and there she was. Stephanie. He always forgot, when he hadn't seen her in a while, how attractive she was. Not standard-issue beautiful. Better. She was almost his height, and he was almost 6 foot. Her coppery hair and tawny skin made her a peculiar brand of redhead, no freckles. Quick to tan if she ever spent time in the sun, which she didn't. She was the only person he'd ever met who had one brown eye and one that was flecked with green. She was wearing admirably fitted jeans. He wished she would turn around so he could become reacquainted with her ass. She greeted him by raising her hand, blocking him from crossing the threshold of the foyer. "Three conditions, Leo," she said. "No drugs. No borrowing money. No fucking." "When have I ever borrowed money from you?" Leo said, feeling the welcome blast of heat from the house. "In the last decade, anyway." "I mean it." Stephanie opened the door wider. She smiled at him, then offered her cheek for a kiss. "It's nice to see you, asshole."
Chapter 4
That Leo had messed up so enormously was disturbing, but his siblings reluctantly agreed, not surprising. That Leo's fuck-up had activated their disengaged mother to exercise her power of attorney and nearly drain the nest, however, was shocking. It was the one threat to the nest none of them had imagined. It had been simply unthinkable.
"Obviously it wasn't unthinkable because I thought of it and your father set it up that way," Francie said, the day she finally agreed to meet them, briefly, in George's New York office, while Leo was still in rehab.
"It was our money, too,"
Jack said. His voice wasn't forceful as he'd intended, more whiny than outraged. And we weren't consulted or even informed until it was too late.
It's not your money until next March, Francie said.
February, Melody said.
Excuse me?
Francie looked slightly taken aback to hear Melody, as if just realizing she was there.
My birthday's in February, Melody said. Not March.
B stopped knitting and raised her hand.
I'm March.
Francie did the thing she always did when wrong, pretended not to be, and corrected whoever had corrected her.
Yes, that's exactly what I said. The money doesn't become yours until February. It's also not completely gone. You will all get $50,000, more or less. Is that correct, George?
In that neighborhood, yes.
George was walking around the conference table pouring everyone coffee, clearly uncomfortable. Melody couldn't stop staring at her mother. She was starting to look old.
How old was she? 71? 72?
Her long, elegant fingers trembled a bit. The veins on the back of her hands were dark and prominent, the slackening skin marred with age spots like a quail's egg. Francie had always been so vain about her hands, demonstrating the reach of her fingers by bending them forward and touching the tips to the inside of her wrists. Pianist's hands, she used to tell Melody when Melody was little. Melody noticed now that Francie consciously placed the left, which was slightly less modeled, atop the right. Her voice had thinned, too. The slightest difference in treble had crept in. Not a rasp or a scratch, but a waver that troubled Melody. Francie's decline meant they were all declining. "You are still receiving a sum of money," Francie continued, "that would make most people incredibly grateful."
"A sum that is 10% of what we were expecting. Is that correct, George?" Jack asked.
"Sounds about right," George said.
10%, Jack said, practically spitting across the table at Francie.
Francie removed a slender gold watch from her wrist and placed it on the table in front of her, as if putting them all on notice that their time was nearly up.
"Your father would have been horrified by that amount. You know he meant the fund to provide a modest assist, not a true inheritance."
"That's entirely beside the point," Jack said. "He set up an account, he deposited money, George managed it very well. Now the deadline is approaching and it's supposed to..."
"Wait a second," Jack turned to George.
"Leo still isn't getting $50,000, is he? Because if he is, that is truly fucked."
"Watch your language," Francie said.
Jack looked at B and Melody, mouth agape, and spread his hands wide. Melody wasn't sure if he was gesturing in frustration or beckoning them to join in the conversation. She looked over at B, who was intently counting stitches on whatever it was she was knitting.
"We're following the terms," Francie said.
"Your mother is right about that," George said. "Leo can refuse his share, but we can't refuse to give it to him."
"Unbelievable," Jack said.
Melody wanted to speak up, but she was stuck on how to address her mother. Her older siblings had started calling Francie by her first name in their teens, but she'd never been able to do it, and something about saying "Mom" in front of Jack and Bea embarrassed her. Also, she was a little scared of her mother. Her mother was a little mean. For years, the Plums had told one another that their mother was just a mean drunk. If she would just stop drinking, they'd say, she'd be fine. Shortly before Leonard died, she developed some out-of-the-blue alcohol intolerance and did stop drinking, cold turkey. Years later, they would realize Francie's sudden sobriety had to do with Harold, the conservative teetotaling businessman and local politician she swiftly married after their father died. They eagerly awaited her transformation, only to discover that they already knew her true nature. She was just a little mean.
"Here's the thing," Melody said, clearing her throat and waving a little in Francie's direction to get her attention. "We've been counting on the money and have made plans,
And Melody hesitated. Francie sighed and clanged her spoon around her coffee cup as if she was stirring in sugar or cream. She let the spoon drop and rattle a little on the saucer.
Yes, Francie said, gesturing for Melody to wind up. You've made plans and...
Melody froze, unsure of what to say next.
This is a blow, Jack said. This is a financial blow on top of several financial hits over the past few years. Is it unreasonable to expect you, as Leo's parent and given your means, to absorb some of this financial loss?
Melody was nodding as Jack spoke and trying to gauge her mother's reaction. There was a part of her, a tiny, contracted part of her, that thought maybe she could get her mother to help with college tuition.
Leo's parent? Francie said, merely looking amused.
Leo is 46, and you're not the only one who has taken a financial hit over the past few years. Not that any of you bothered to inquire after us.
Why? Bea asked. Are you and Harold okay?
Francie had folded her hands in front of her and was looking down at the table. She started to speak and then stopped. Bea and Melody and Jack looked at one another nervously.
Harold and I are fine, she finally said.
Well, then, Jack started, but Francie put up a hand.
We will be fine. But most of Harold's money is tied up in commercial real estate, which is a soft market right now, obviously.
And the money Dad left for you?
It's long gone. We used it to shore up Harold's business until we were on an upswing.
Francie straightened her shoulders and raised her voice a little, like a teacher reassuring a room of students during a fire drill.
Everything will be absolutely fine when the market corrects the way it always does. In the meantime, we've had to cut back, too. Harold has his own children to consider.
At the moment, our liquid assets are negligible, and that will be our situation for quite some time. We've all had to readjust our expectations and plans given the recent economy.
Francie leaned back in her chair and crossed her arms, appraising her offspring.
Besides, Leo is your brother. It never occurred to me that you would not help him out of this dire situation.
A situation entirely of his own making, Jack said.
Francie pointed a finger at Jack.
Your father set the conditions of the account so that I could tap into it in case of an emergency for this exact reason. This was a family emergency.
Which part qualifies as an emergency? Jack said. Leo's years of no work and all play, his marriage to a world-class spendthrift, crashing a Porsche he couldn't afford because his dick was in a waitress's fist.
Across the table, Francie put the tips of her unsteady fingers to her eyelids, which were creased with a violet shadow, making the lids look more bruised than anything else.
I don't want to have this conversation again.
She opened her eyes and looked around the table, surprised, as always, when face to face with her children.
Francie knew she wouldn't win any prizes for motherhood. She'd never aspired to any. But she hadn't been this horrible, had she?
What had Leonard wrought with the money he thought would just be a small dividend later in their lives? How had they raised children who were so impractical and yet still so entitled? Maybe it was her fault. She'd wondered that often enough, what mother hadn't. She'd been 25 and married less than a year when Leo was born, and Jack and Bea had followed so quickly. She'd been overwhelmed to the point of being listless. And just when she felt she was coming back to her old self, gaining control of the situation, Leo was 6, Jack 4, Bea months away from 3, everyone finally sleeping, and, surprise, Melody. She was bereft when she found herself pregnant with Melody, and for many years after, counting down the hours of the days until she could have a drink to dampen her anxiety. These days, she supposed, she'd be diagnosed with postnatal something and given a pill, and maybe it would be different. Harold, solid, confident, reassuring Harold, had rescued her. Maybe the fault was with her marriage to Leonard. Their relationship had been fraught, disconnected, except for the sex.
She still thought about having sex with Leonard, his unlikely voracious exuberance, her ability to be yielding and attentive in bed in a way she wasn't anywhere else. If only they'd been a little more careful about family planning. And probably their parenting had suffered as a result. But had they really been different from anyone of their generation? She didn't think so. Mom? Francie was jolted back into the conference room by Melody's voice, away from the pleasant memory of Leonard and the unlikely places they would couple when the children were little and everywhere and wanting her constantly. The laundry room with its locked door had been a favorite, the whirring and thumping of the washer and dryer giving them a certain auditory privacy. She still had a Pavlovian type of arousal when she smelled Clorox. And here they were. Her children. Three of them, anyway. Jack, who had emerged from the womb aloof and self-contained. He was always trying to sell Francie some inferior kind of antique for her house, something from his shop that was overvalued and overpriced. She didn't know if he was dumb or if he just thought she was. Beatrice had seemed like the easiest of the four, but then she wrote those stories. Francie was proud when the first one was published, ready to buy dozens of copies and show them to her friends, until she read the story with a character who was meant to be her, a mother described as distant and casually cruel. She'd never mentioned the story to B, but she still remembered bits. A woman who viewed the world through a prism of bottomless desire, her soul fluency, disappointment. Luckily, her friends didn't read those kind of magazines anyway. They read Town and Country. They read Ladies' Home Journal. Bede always had her secrets. Always. Francie wondered what was going on in that bowed head now as her hands flew with needles and yarn. And Melody. Maybe she would slip Melody some cash, enough for some Botox or a facial or something to brighten her pallor. She was the youngest and somehow the most faded, as if the plum DNA had thinned with each conception, strong and robust with Leo, and each child after being a little less. She couldn't claim to be close to Leo, but he was the least needy and, therefore, the one she thought of with the most fondness. She'd helped Leo because Harold had insisted she take care of the situation as swiftly as possible. He didn't want any of his multiple business partners, already skittish in the current financial environment, to associate him with a publicly humiliating and possibly financially gutting lawsuit. George's connections, the family's long-standing reputation locally, and a fat check got the job done. But she'd also taken pleasure in her magnanimous gesture. She'd felt, for a change, capable and maternal. She liked being able to wipe the slate for Leo and offer him a second chance. She believed in second chances, sometimes more than first chances, which were wasted on youth and indiscretion. Her second marriage was the one she deserved, even if it was a little staid, a little lacking in drama and the physical connection she had with Leonard. But Harold was good to her. She was taken care of. Her bottomless desires satisfied. And still she had to contend with this execution squad of her own children, complete with Madame Defarge at the head of the conference table. Who was casually cruel now? This was how it had always been. Nothing she did was good enough. What she did for one disappointed another. She couldn't win. When would it end? She searched their faces again, looking for some sign, some small indicator that they'd come from her and Leonard. Aside from physical traits, the easiest mark to hit, she could see nothing. Nothing. All she could think was, "I don't recognize a single one of you." "Mom," Melody said again. "This is a conversation you need to have with Leo," Francie finally said. "I'm sure he will be able to repay you as soon as he's settled with Victoria. I understand he's selling nearly everything, the apartment, the artwork. Isn't that right, George?" George cleared his throat, made a little steeple with his fingers, and squinted as if a bright ray of sun had suddenly appeared in the windowless conference room.
He is, but I have to tell you that most of it is going to Victoria.
What do you mean by most of it? Melody said.
I mean, pretty much all of it. There will be some left, enough to tide him over for a bit, help him get settled until he finds a job. George paused, knowing he was delivering more bad news. As you can imagine, Victoria could have made things quite difficult, and this was how it shook out.
What about Leo's insurance? Melody said. Shouldn't he have some kind of liability coverage?
Yes. Well, that was another unexpected complication. It seems Leo had lapsed payment on quite a few bills, including insurance.
Jack massaged his temples as if tending to a migraine.
So let me recap. Essentially, all Leo's assets are going to paying off Victoria to get rid of her, keep her quiet, whatever, and all of our money is going to the waitress because of Leo's mess.
George shrugged. I would phrase it in a more nuanced fashion, but essentially,
yes.
Matilda Rodriguez, B said.
Jack and Melody looked at B, confused.
Her name, B said, impatient. You could at least use the waitress's name.
Are you humming? Jack said, turning to Melody.
What?
Melody startled. She was humming. It was a nervous habit, something she did when she was worried or anxious. She was trying not to think about the accident.
Sorry,
she said to the room.
You don't have to apologize for humming, B said. For God's sake.
It's that song from Cats, Jack said. I want to scream. Before we wind up, Francie said, cutting off the all-too-familiar bickering, I'd like to acknowledge all George's work. I won't go into the specifics, but suffice it to say that getting Leo to rehab, negotiating the settlement, doing what needed to be done at the local level to take care of this, keep it out of the paper, was a superb effort, and we've been remiss in not thanking him yet for his truly excellent effort, the speed and the efficiency and so on and so forth. She nodded at George like a monarch recognizing a loyal subject.
We were lucky, George said, avoiding looking at B, whose hands had stilled.
Things broke our way, and your mother is right. This could have been much, much worse. I file this one under best-case scenarios.
I guess we have a slightly different filing system, Melody said.
This is in all our best interests.
Francie stood and pulled on her coat.
Melody had to stop herself from reaching over to touch the rich navy fabric. We don't want this all over the East End.
I don't care what's on the East End, Jack said.
Me neither, said B, aware that the meeting was about to wrap up and maybe she'd been just a little too quiet.
Francie was wrapping a lavender scarf around her neck. Melody stared. The scarf was so light and diaphanous it reminded her of a passage from a children's book she used to read to the girls when they were little, about a princess who had a dress that had been spun by moths from moonlight.
Your scarf, Melody said. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Francie looked surprised. She fingered the cloth a little and then unwound the scarf, folded it into a neat square and pushed it across the conference table until it was in front of Melody.
Here, she said. Take it.
Really?
Melody, in spite of herself, was thrilled. She had never owned anything quite so delicate. It had to be expensive.
Are you sure?
I'm sure, Francie said, pleased to see the appreciation on Melody's face. It's your color. It will brighten the pallor a bit.
Have you spoken to Leo lately? B asked Francie.
Francie watched Melody wrap the scarf around her neck. It wasn't her color, but it still looked nice. She motioned for Melody to come closer, and she adjusted the ends of the scarf, tucking them into place.
There, she said.
She turned to B. I spoke to him last week. Briefly.
Is he okay? B said.
Francie shrugged. He's Leo. He sounded perfectly fine, considering. "Does he understand your intentions?" Jack said. "That your incredible generosity on our behalf is not a gift but a loan?" "I'm sure Leo doesn't need to be told to be accountable for the money. He's not dumb." Francie was pulling on her gloves now. "But he's Leo," Jack said. "He's supposed to magically start caring about what happens to us?"
"We should give him a chance," Bee said.
"You're all delusional," Jack said. He sounded more tired than angry now. Francie's brief sense of accomplishment over gifting Melody the scarf evaporated. She gave no one in particular a brittle flash of smile. "I'll make sure he gets in touch with you as soon as he's back in the city," Francie said. "I can do that."
"And then what?" Jack asked.
Francie shrugged.
"Invite him to lunch."
Chapter 5 Meeting at the Grand Central Oyster Bar was part convenience. Melody disembarked at Grand Central, which was halfway between downtown where Jack and Leo lived, and Beatrice's place uptown, and part nostalgia. On the rare occasion the Elder Plums brought all four children into the city, they would always dine at the Oyster Bar, summoning plates of oysters with exotic names. Chincoteague, Emerald Cove, Pemaquid, and steaming bowls of oyster stew. The Plum siblings loved the bustle of the dining room where they never sat, and the ordered efficiency of the sprawling, no-reservations-needed sit-down counter where they always sat. They loved the dramatically vaulted ceilings covered in ivory Gustavino tiles and the strings of white lights that managed to make the space feel both lushly romantic and slightly antiseptic. Melody had arrived early to intercept her brothers and sister before they found seats at the counter. She'd made the bold move of reserving them a table in the dining room. She was sick of the counter. It was hard for a group of four to talk when sitting in a row unless they got an end spot, which rarely happened. They needed to talk today, and she'd always wanted to eat in the dining room sitting around a table, like civilized New Yorkers would. But Leo was late, and the maitre d' would only seat a complete party. They'd ended up at the counter, fending off the waiter with orders of shrimp cocktail and Coke. "We could have just said we were three and then pulled up a chair when Leo comes," Jack said. "If he comes."
"He'll be here," Bee said.
"You've spoken to him?" Jack asked.
"No, but he'll be here."
Melody was glumly opening another pack of oyster crackers. The maitre d' had snapped her head off when she'd asked if he'd save them a corner table. "Madame," he said sourly, "please enjoy yourself at the counter seats."
"Have you spoken to him?" Jack asked Melody.
"Me?" Melody said, surprised.
"No, Leo never calls me."
"I got an email from him at work on Friday," Bee said, "but since he's not here yet, maybe we should talk about what to say when he does get here." The three of them squirmed on their stools a bit, eyed one another warily.
"Well," Melody said, "I..."
"Go on," Bee said.
"I think we should, obviously, make sure he's okay."
Melody spoke haltingly. She was unaccustomed to going first. Jack looked dubious. Bee smiled encouragingly. Melody sat up a little straighter.
"I think we inquire after his health, find out where he's staying, offer our support."
Bee was nodding along to everything Melody said.
"Agreed," Bee said.
"And then?" Jack said, pointedly.
"And then I guess we ask about the nest," Melody said. "I don't know. How would you like to start?"
"I'd like to hand him an invoice and ask him when he's paying it," Jack said. Bee swiveled on her stool to face Jack.
"Are you guys in some kind of financial trouble? Is Walker not working or something?"
Jack let out an exasperated puff. "Walker is working. Walker is always working. I would like to offer Walker the opportunity to not work for a bit. Eventually. As in next year, which was our plan and has been our plan forever, that Walker could cut back and we'd spend more time in the country."
Jack trailed off. He was not comfortable talking to his sisters about any of this. He wanted to get Leo alone and make his pitch for payback priority without the other two interfering.
"I'm worried too, you know," Melody said. "Soon we'll be paying college tuition. You can't imagine what it costs now. And the house..."
"What about the house?" Bea asked. Melody didn't want to talk about her house, about Walter's completely insane and unacceptable idea about her house.
"It's expensive," she said.
Bea waved at the waiter and gestured for drink refills. "I get that this stinks for all of us," she said, "but I also know Leo. If we go on the offensive today..." She shrugged and looked back and forth at Melody and Jack.
"You know I'm right. He'll just avoid us."
"He can't avoid us forever," Jack said.
"What are we going to do?" Bea said. "Stake him out? Garnish his non-existent wages? Beg?"
"I think Bee's right," Melody said. "Since when has being nice to Leo worked?" Jack said. "Since when has anything successfully forced Leo to not put Leo first?"
"People change," Bea said, opening up another pack of oyster crackers.
"More often, people stay exactly the same."
"I still don't understand why he didn't fight Victoria on the apartment and everything else," Melody said. "Why he didn't try harder to recover something."
"You don't?" Bea had a flash of that night in the ER. Leo's face, his sutured chin, the whispers and moans on the other side of the curtain, the sobbing parents in the hallway, the mother quietly keening and fingering a rosary.
"I do," she said. "You would, too, if you'd been there."
Melody became very invested in fishing a wedge of lemon from her soft drink and not thinking about the waitress. They'd been out of town the weekend of the wedding and had missed the entire mess. Jack had missed it, too. He never attended family functions. Melody needed to keep her energy focused on where it mattered. Her daughters, her husband, her home.
"Oh, please," Jack said. "That's hardly the whole story. Something else is going on."
He was creating tiny origami-like folds on one corner of the paper placemat. "This is Leo we're talking about. He's got money hidden away somewhere. I know it."
"What do you mean you know it?" Melody said. "You have proof?"
"No, but it's the only thing that makes sense. I know it in my bones. Think about it. Since when has Leo been afraid of a fight?"
"Bea, what do you think?" Melody said.
"I don't know," Bea said, but the same thought had occurred to her. "How would that even work?"
"Oh, there are ways," Jack said. "It's surprisingly easy."
The waiter was circling them now, annoyed. They'd decimated countless packs of oyster crackers, and empty cellophane wrappers and crumbs littered the space in front of them. Bea started gathering the crumbs into a small pile and brushing them onto a bread and butter plate.
"He's not coming," Jack said.
Bea checked her phone.
"He's just on Leo time."
Then, as if on cue, Bea saw Melody sit up a little straighter and raise her left hand and nervously fluff her two blonde bangs. A tentative smile lifted the lower half of her face. Jack straightened, too. His jaw slid forward the way it did when he was feeling defensive. But then he stood and gave a beckoning wave, and before Bea could turn around, she felt a hand on her shoulder, its familiar heft and quiet, preferential squeeze. And her heart did a tiny two-step, a little jig of relief, and she turned and looked up, and there he was. Leo. Chapter 6. The day Leo landed on Stephanie's stoop, she immediately put him to work moving firewood from the half-cord piled in her backyard to a smaller area on the deck off her kitchen and under a plastic tarp, in case the storm turned out to be as nasty as the weather report was predicting. As Leo stacked wood, his phone buzzed. It was his slip of paper calling back, and lo and behold, the voice on the other end was an old familiar dealer, Rico. They exchanged quick pleasantries and hurriedly arranged to meet at their usual spot, Enrico's car parked off Central Park West near Strawberry Fields 3 days hence, immediately before the family lunch. Nothing major. A little weed to relax, maybe some Vicodin. Maybe he wouldn't even go. Maybe he'd try to stay clear-headed for a few more weeks, see what that was like. Leo liked options. Stephanie stuck her head out the door and asked him to bring some wood into the living room. As he moved through the parlor floor, he admired what she'd done to the house, how she'd preserved everything old but also made it feel modern, entirely her own. Stephanie'd had the foresight to buy at the end of Giuliani's reign as mayor, only weeks after 9/11, during what would turn out to be the tiniest of real estate dips. When she moved to the block on the wrong side of Flatbush Avenue, the non-Park Slope side, everyone, including Leo, thought she was crazy. One of the houses on the corner was occupied by a thriving drug business. Her house had ugly metal gates on the front and back windows. The door off the kitchen, leading to an unused and rotting deck, had been cemented shut with concrete blocks. But the day she looked at the building, she noticed city workers planting cherry trees along her side of the street, which she knew signaled an active neighborhood association. There was a decent garden floor rental beneath the owner's triplex. And then there was the sheer size of the place. She could fit three of her Upper West Side studios into the first floor. As she wandered the neighborhood that day, she counted three couples with strollers. Her agency was thriving, and she'd always lived frugally, saving as much as she could. She offered the asking price.
"When did you get such good taste?" Leo asked her. "Where's all that crap from IKEA I had to help you put together?"
"You aren't the only one who grew up and started making money, Leo. I haven't had the IKEA furniture for years." She walked into the living room from the kitchen, wiping her hands on a dish towel, happy to admire her house along with him. She loved her house. It was her baby.
"Italianate, right?" Leo said, examining the ornate marble mantelpiece.
The center medallion of the mantle was a carving of a young girl. Marble curls of hair fell around her face. Her nose was long and straight, her gaze direct, her lips full. He ran his thumb over the mouth, feeling the hard edge of a tiny chip at the center of the lower lip. The imperfection made the young woman's mouth both damaged and oddly alluring.
"Isn't she perfect?" Stephanie said.
"Most mantles I've seen have carved fruit or flowers. I've never seen another face. I like to imagine she meant something to the person who built this house. Maybe she was a daughter, a wife."
"She reminds me of someone."
"Me too. I can't ever think of who."
"She has nice tits."
"Don't be gross." Stephanie knew Leo was provoking her.
"Sorry."
He moved over to the fire and threw more wood onto the flames, watching it flare as he agitated the embers with an iron poker.
"She has a lovely décolletage."
"Better?"
"Stop staring at defenseless Lillian's breasts."
"Please don't tell me you've given her a name," Leo said, shaking his head. "Please tell me someone else named her Lillian."
"I named her Lillian. Sometimes we chat. Don't touch her breasts."
"Truly, I'm not that hard up."
He sat on one of the sofas flanking the hearth, scanning the room for signs of a male presence.
"No more cravat?"
Stephanie couldn't help smiling a little. Cravat was Leo's nickname for one of her post-Leo boyfriends, a guy who'd lived with her once and briefly and had made the unfortunate choice one evening of wearing a velvet jacket and a silk cravat to a book party. "He hasn't lived here in years."
"Not enough room for all his smoking jackets?"
She shook her head. "Do I really still have to defend one bad wardrobe choice from years ago?
I also recall a summertime straw fedora."
"You always did have great recall for anything that made you feel superior."
"What can I say? I'm not a hat and cravat guy."
"Turns out we have that in common." Leo removed his damp shoes and put them close to the hearth to dry a little. He put his feet up on the coffee table. She sat down opposite him.
"You always knew how to pick them," Leo said.
I had some great picks.
Like who? Leo said, encouraged by what could have been a slightly flirtatious turn in her tone.
Will Peck.
The firefighter?
Yes, the firefighter. That guy was great. Easy.
Leo was genuinely stunned. He'd met the firefighter once, remembered him as being disturbingly good-looking and fit, an ex-Marine or something equally stalwart. Setting aside physical strength, which I will cede to the Marine.
Don't be such a snob. Will's an intellectual, a Renaissance man.
A Renaissance man? Leo couldn't keep the mockery from his tone.
Yes, he